Today we talk about quantum phase transitions. So we have a family of Hamiltonians that are local and smooth in some parameters lambda. And because of what we said yesterday, we are interested in some non-analyticity in the energy of the ground state. Okay? So we will consider the ground state energy E0 of lambda, and we argued yesterday that a definition of quantum phase transition would be those values of lambda such that this function is non-analytic. So let's try to understand in practice what are the two mechanisms such that this can happen. So the first mechanism is called level crossing. So let me sketch it. So let's say that this is one of our parameters lambda. And here we plot the energies E1 lambda and E0 lambda, and say that for lambda equals 0, at the beginning there is this gap between the ground state energy and the first excited state. And now as this lambda increases, these two functions behave, for instance, like that. Okay, so this is a level crossing. A typical example in which this can happen is that, for instance, your Hamiltonian as a function of lambda has this form. So remember that because this is an Hermitian operator, this is a trick that we'll be using a lot in this course. We can write it in its spectral resolution, which means that we write it as some energy, and then that depends on lambda, and then the projector on some state. And then we can have another energy and the projector onto another state that is orthogonal to this one. And we keep going with all the other orthogonal terms. Now imagine that these energies depend on lambda in this way. We just multiply by lambda. So you see that at some point they have to cross. And and the thing is that then the real ground state energy is this, right? It's this one in pink. Because by definition, it's the energy of the lowest level. Okay, so you see that at the crossing point, this derivative is discontinuous. because it's positive and then negative. Okay? So these are called first order quantum phase transitions. And they are of some importance, and there are many phase transitions in which this phenomenon is important. However, they are not the main focus of our course. And the reason is there is nothing here that depends on the thermodynamic limit. This is not the property of something that is emerging. You see, even just a two-level system, even if I don't have all these other terms, can display a level crossing. So because of that, for our goals, these quantum phase transitions are not very interesting. We are interested in something that only happens in the thermodynamic limit. Okay? It must be a feature of the collective behavior of the full system. The second mechanism is the so-called avoided level crossing. And the picture is the following. Imagine, again, we have lambda, and we have our two levels. Let me use another color. And this is the first excited state, and this is the ground state. And they are about to cross, but it's an avoided level cross. And again, we can call, so if this is E1 of lambda, and this is E0 of lambda, you see that here we have a minimum gap, delta E of lambda. So in general, delta E of lambda, and let me call this value of lambda, lambda C. In general, delta E of lambda is, again, just the gap, the difference between the first excited, the energy of the first excited state and the energy of the ground state. Okay. So what can happen in a many-body system is that they do not cross like this. However, there is a point, or sometimes it's many points, but let's say there is at least a point such that this gap vanishes in the thermodynamic limit. Okay? So we are considering the situation such that the limit for n going to infinity of delta E of lambda at lambda equal lambda c goes to zero. Okay, so it becomes gapless in the thermodynamic limit. Okay, so this is called the continuous or second order phase transition, and you can try to do this as an exercise, but it's something that we will be doing later. But for your curiosity, you can try now already and show that if this is the case, then in the thermodynamic limit, some derivative of order higher than one must become discontinuous. And the hint to do this is to do it in perturbation theory. So you write the derivative by considering a small deviation of your state, because I changed a little bit lambda. And when you do perturbation theory at various orders,
you have at the denominator the gap. So you have the gap at the denominator at the first order in perturbation theory, the gap square in the second order, and so on and so forth. So the vanishing of the gap would imply that some of these derivatives blows up. Okay. And we are concerned with this, because this, by definition, is only happening when it happens in the thermodynamic limit. And so what happens, what is the behavior that we typically observe? The behavior that we typically observe is that in the thermodynamic limit near the critical point, so now we are lambda is near lambda c, the gap will be like this, lambda minus lambda c to the minus zeta nu. Okay, you see, this is the same type of critical behavior that we described for classical systems. Plus zeta nu, so it's vanishing as lambda approaches lambda c. Whereas the correlation length, so what is a correlation length? We will see that we have correlation functions, let me call them gr, that go like this. So they decay with the correlation length xi, but near the critical point, the correlation length diverges. Okay? Which means that this function becomes a power law. And we can also see that, or sometimes I will call delta I just delta, that the inverse gap then must be psi to the power z. And this is also an example of something that maybe you know from quantum field theory. When you use propagators, here a correlation function is like a propagator. And you see that the inverse of the gap is related to the correlation length for your fields or for your particles. Okay. Good. Okay, so this is a typical behavior of quantum many-body systems where you have a vanishing gap. And we will explore this behavior in some specific model, and we will start with the quantumizing model. And okay, so what is the quantumizing model? We start with a graph. Okay, and then we have a Hilbert space associated to the sides of this graph. Okay, and the local Hilbert space will be C2, which means just the span of just the two states, 0 and 1, or so-called spin up and spin down. Okay, so this is a system with n spins 1 off. Okay, so this is the Hilbert space. Now I have to give you the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian of the model is, I always forget whether I put a G in the first term or in the second term. In the first term, okay. Okay, so this is the Ising model. And as you can see, capital J is just an overall energy scale, so we have only one parameter here, which is this G. What does this mean? This is the sum over all the edges in your lattice. And in this notation, I'm also telling you our lattice is as edges, just links. So, you know, you could have it on a chain, on a square lattice, on any graph made of links, you can define the Ising model. And we will solve it on a chain, okay? Because on a chain, there is a way to find an exact analytical solution. But the consideration that we're gonna do now do not depend on this topology. So they're more general. Okay, so one other thing you should notice is that, so first of all, many times in literature, you just find sigma I, sigma j. You don't see this tensor product symbol. But there should be that symbol there, because this means that this is operating on the Hilbert space at the site I, that is operating to 0 and 1 at the site I, and this one is operating on another Hilbert space. So that must be the tensor product. It's omitted, and we will omit in the future to make the notation lighter, but you have to see it in your mind. And at the same time, another thing that we should be seeing is that in the end, this is an operator on what Hilbert space?
H-lat.
Yeah, so Hg is, it's an operator on here, right? But the way I wrote this, for instance, this is an operator on just Hi, and this is an operator just on Hi tensor Hj, so there is some mismatch, right? So what we mean, and again, we don't do it to make notation lighter, is that we imply that this is the identity everywhere else. And this is the identity on the Hilbert space of lambda minus the site ij. Then, of course, you know, if we start writing all these things, it becomes very heavy. So we will not do that. I'm doing it just now to make things clear. So there are operators on the full Hilbert space, but their support is just on I and ij. The support is the place where it is non-trivial, but it is not just the identity. Okay? Very good. So let's look, and we are interested in the ground state of this model as a function of G. Okay? Because everything we want to know about quantum phases is a property of the manifold of ground states as a function of these parameters. So let's start examining what is the ground state in two limits, when G is very large and when G is zero. So when G goes to infinity, this is the so-called paramagnetic phase. Okay, so when G is in infinite, what I really mean is that I can neglect this term, right? What I mean is that this is the only term that counts.
So this is all our Hamiltonian. So what do you think? Let me call this ground state psi zero p. P because of paramagnetic phase. Can you tell me what it looks like?
All spins
along the x direction. So in the eigenstates of sigma xi, right? So it is the tensor product of all the spins in the eigenstate with eigenvalue plus one of the operator sigma xi that we customarily indicated by plus, plus being 0 plus 1 over square root of 2. You know this is the eigenstate of eigenvalue plus 1 of sigma x.
Sorry, why we should make that operator sigma x but not sigma z?
Oh, this is a beautiful question. OK. So so why is of course I could, you know, if I put sigma z, then it's another model, right? This is a definition. So one answer is I define the quantum missing IC model, the one with the x. Okay. But I actually want to address your question, you know, but why this is the one that is interesting and not the one with the sigma z. Okay, so the answer comes in two parts. The first part is, and this is actually very interesting, imagine I had done this. Okay, so let's try this game. Now, you see that the ground state for every G of this model is still all the spins pointing in the plus direction. Okay? So there is nothing very interesting in changing G, first of all. No matter what is G, these two terms commute, and to minimize the energies, you want all the spins in the plus direction. Okay. Moreover, also the other eigenstates, all the spectrum, what states are they? For instance, how do you create excitations about, so the ground state is all spins, all plus. Okay? Then how do you create an excitation?
Is it immediately the same case as the classical situation?
Huh?
If you change the sigma x to sigma z, will it immediately be the same case as our classical one?
Perfect. Perfect. If you have sigma z, all the eigenstates are just spin configurations. Means every spin configuration, by spin configuration, remember, means that to every spin, I assign a value, 0 or 1. Which means that sigma z in 0 is 1. Remember, this is like the icing spin being plus 1. And in 1, this is minus 1. So you see that all the, and this is an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian with z. So you see that all the energies are just, and all the eigenstates are the same of the classical model. In fact, this model is actually entirely classical because all its spectrum, all its eigenstates are classical. The fact that we wrote it with operators doesn't just make it quantum, at least at the level of equilibrium states. The equilibrium states are completely classical. But if I put sigma x here, then they do not commute. Okay? If they do not commute, in general, the ground state is not just a spin. The ground state and the excited states are not just a spin configuration, but they will be a superposition of these states. And the superposition of these states are what we need to have fluctuations, right? If your quantum state is just one eigenstate, well, then there will be no fluctuations in the observables like sigma x and sigma z. And we know that if we want to have something interesting, we need to have fluctuations. If we want to have a quantum phase transition, we want the fluctuations at the critical point to explode. And this would happen for the classical model in temperature. So when we look at the Gibbs state, which is what we saw yesterday, right? In that case, the probability distribution was given by the Boltzmann weight. But now we are at zero temperature. So your probability distribution must be made by the weights of the superpositions of these objects. And to have superposition, you need operators that do not commute. So that's why we put sigma x. That's why it's interesting. Very well. And there is also a second reason that I'm going to say in a second. OK. So this is our ground state. And then there is a quantity called local order parameter, which is the magnetization per site. Right? Remember, it's the same thing that we did in the classical model. And remember, in the classical model we wrote this. And now what is this? What is replacing this is this object evaluated in the ground state. OK, and now you see that since psi 0 is the tensor product of pluses, each of the sigma z on plus gives you what? So it gives you minus, right? It gives you 0 minus 1. And then the overlap with plus would be 0. So this is identically 0. So because this is what we call the order parameter, so this is telling us what is the magnetization, and there is no magnetization, then this phase, that's why it's called paramagnetic, or it's a disordered phase. Okay. Now, some of you, yeah, I want this question. Let's see.
It's just I was wondering, maybe two questions.
Yeah.
So, first, how in practice or what kind of atoms could we get spins that interact along with sigma z, but with an external field g, for example, they interact with sigma x.
Okay. Yeah. So experimentally, there is some alloy of lithium oxide that has this type of interactions, Ising interactions. Then this is just an external magnetic field. Okay, this is just the coupling with an external magnetic field. Yeah.
So then maybe why? When we look at M as the direction of the spin along Z and not X if we...
Right, this is the question I want. Okay, so why we use sigma Z here as an order parameter
So while we break this imagined symmetry between x and z, and we don't use sigma x, I want some suggestions why we do that.
If we are interested only in the relative orientation of the spins with respect to each other, not with an external.
Is it only a man-made choice? I think in principle we can have different order parameter, but we only for now we're only interested in one.
Okay, so that is true, but let me say that for this model, this is the only order parameter. Let me state this very, very firmly. Sigma x is not an order parameter. Okay, so this begs the question, what makes an operator an order parameter, right? Because so far all I've said is, oh, I call this the order parameter. Okay. So first of all, notice this. So classically, when our parameter that we are changing is the temperature, remember we have that the phase at low temperature has some net magnetization, and the phase at high temperature has zero magnetization. And this is the magnetization obtained with zero external magnetic field. It's the so-called residual magnetization, or more importantly, the spontaneous magnetization. If you place an external magnetic field, even at high temperature, you will have some M, because you are just forcing the spins to be in that direction. The interesting thing that tells us, oh, here there is some kind of order, is that without external magnetic field, at low temperature, you have some magnetization, and at high temperature, you have no magnetization. Now let's go to the quantum case. Now here we do not have temperature, okay? We have G as a parameter. But now, because there are, it's quantum mechanics, there are incompatible measurements, there is not just the magnetization. There is the magnetization along X, along Z, and also along Y. But let's stick with X and Z. And the magnet in this phase, when you have this Hamiltonian, the magnetization along X doesn't have any meaning. There is nothing spontaneous about that. It is polarized along X. We know that. I force the spins to polarize along X because my Hamiltonian is making me pay an energy if I don't do that. So you can ask what is the magnetization in the direction X, and you would get a non-vanishing value, but this has no meaning. It's not anything spontaneous. It's not a sign of order. But the magnetization in the Z direction, because this Hamiltonian is neutral with respect to the Z direction, you see? Then that would tell us something. And it just so happens that it is zero. So it is not magnetized in the Z direction. That's why this is a paramagnet. Yeah?
I have two questions. The first one maybe sounds silly. So why the sigma y is not an order?
Sigma y is like sigma x.
Why? Because it's also neutral in the y direction.
Um, I agree. So what I'm saying is that sigma y
can also be a pair algebra.
Sigma y behaves like sigma x. So I agree that I could have put sigma y here.
Uh-huh.
It has the same commutation relationship with this term as, apart from I, than sigma x.
Yes, but my question is that you are saying if something is neutral to the external magnetic field, then we say that it can be an order parameter?
Yeah, I will tell you in a second. Okay.
Okay.
So my point is that it is not very important whether this is x or y or z, or if this is x or y or z. The only thing that matters is that this is different from this.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so this restores some kind of symmetry. Okay, so if that is your question, you are right. But there is a difference between, so I could put y here and x here.
Yeah, okay. I mean, for this Hamiltonian, I mean, that can sigma y be an algebra. Or is it independent of sigma z, the algebra?
No, for the same Hamiltonian, sigma y would not be a good order parameter. We are going to see it in a second in the other phase, okay?
Okay.
So the other thing I want to look at are the correlation functions. So which are these objects. So this is the non-connected part. You know, if you want the connected part, we also have to subtract these terms, right? But they are zero. So this is the same. However, also this is zero. So you see, there are no correlations between spins at different sites. Well, you know, this is a very boring state. It's all spins pointing in the same direction. So of course, there are no correlations in the z direction. All right. So maybe what we are seeing here is a feature of this state being so boring. Maybe we would like to switch on this term a little bit and see what happens. So now imagine that I consider G very large, so that this term is still predominant. Okay? But now I don't know how to solve this, right? Now it's not so easy to understand what is the ground state. In fact, tomorrow we will actually diagonalize on a chain the system exactly. And that's an incredibly instructive piece of theoretical physics. But now let's stay still at this simpler level. So let's say that I don't know the exact solution. But I want G just very large, not infinite. So how can I argue in this case? What would you do? Perfect. You would do perturbation theory, treating this as a perturbation, right? Because this is very small. And this is exactly what you are going to do today in the tutorial. Okay? It's just ordinary quantum mechanics perturbation theory with the complication that now this is a many-body system, it's not a single particle system. And you will find something. You will find that M is still zero and that these correlation functions are actually not zero, but go like e to the minus I minus j over Xi. And this Xi is given to you by the perturbation theory. So the perturbation theory will give you what Xi is.
So you see this behavior in which the so-called order parameter is zero and connected correlation functions are very small. So they are small when you are away from some typical distance xi. It's not just a property of one point. It's not just the property of the g equal infinity, but there is a finite range of g that at this point we don't really know, because we don't know when this perturbation theory will break down, right? Because I can make this a perturbation, then I can make g smaller and smaller and smaller. Will it always go through this perturbation theory, or it will break down? For g large enough, we know it's good. So we don't know, okay, at this point. But at the very least, we know that there is a finite range of g such that this result holds. So that's why we call this not just the property of a point, but of a full phase, a full ensemble of states that have no order. Okay. Very important remark. This Hamiltonian, for every value of G, has a symmetry, has a global symmetry, which means it's some operator that does not depend on a single Hilbert space, such that it's a symmetry means that the Hamiltonian commutes with this operator. Let me call it T. So T is a global symmetry. Can you, by inspection of the Hamiltonian, find what is this operator? There must be an operator that commutes with all the terms of the Hamiltonian. Huh?
Sigma squared.
Sigma square?
Sigma x squared, sigma y squared.
No, the global symmetry is this one. Sigma x on all the spins at the same time. Let's see. T obviously commutes with the first term, but also commutes with the second term, because it is true that sigma x anti-commutes with sigma z, but in the second term, sigma z is always in pairs, so, and this string always gets both the members in this pair, so you anti-commute twice, which is commuting, so yeah. Maybe it's a very simple exercise to actually do that. Just find the commutation relationship between this operator and sigma z, but you kind of see that this is true, right? Okay, so this is a global symmetry, which means that if I take the ground state, and I operate with T on it, I do not change the energy. However, in this phase, there is something more than that. The ground state, psi, paramagnetic, now I'm writing it as a density matrix so that it is an operator. What is it, right? It is this state. Is the global plus times the global plus. You see that also this operator commutes with the symmetry.
Or in other words, if you want to see it in terms of operators and cats, this is my global plus. Okay. But these are eigenstates of this sigma XS operator, so you get again the same thing. It's invariant. So what happens, what do you call this situation when you have a Hamiltonian that enjoys some symmetry, and then the ground state of this Hamiltonian enjoys the exact same symmetry?
Symmetry not broken.
We say that the symmetry is not broken. And now we have also the second reason to your question, why we don't use sigma z. If we use the sigma z, we would have a very boring Hamiltonian because it has no symmetry. Right? Because sigma z breaks this T symmetry, does not commute with that. So, and the most important fact of this Hamiltonian is that it is symmetric for T. Now notice that if I take the set T and the identity, they form a group, right? Because T times the identity is T. The identity sometimes itself is the identity. And T squared is the identity. So this is a group, you don't get out of it. In fact, it's a representation on this Hilbert space of the group with just two elements, which is what we call Z2. So this Hamiltonian is the paramount example of the simplest possible symmetry that you have, which is Z2. All right. Now let's go to the other limit. G equals 0. Okay. So if G is equal to 0, our Hamiltonian looks like the classical Hamiltonian, right? Sigma z, sigma z. But we'll see that there is an important difference. Okay, so now what are the ground states or the ground state for G equals 0, can you help me? Great, so all spins up or all spins down are both ground states of this Hamiltonian. Do you agree with that? Okay. But now we see that although this Hamiltonian looks classical, because there is a degeneracy, right? Because these are both ground states, now actually quantum mechanics, when there is a degeneracy, does play a role. In fact, why you are saying that these are the only two ground states? Do we really have only two ground states? Can you elaborate?
We have superpositions.
All the superpositions of these two states are ground states. So it's in fact very misleading, although you find it in many books, that you say, oh, you know, you have two ground states. No, what you have is a ground subspace that is two-dimensional. And this ground subspace, let me call it LGS, is the span of these two states. Yep.
However, when you measure it, then you're measuring one, two, right?
That's an amazing question.
Is that so? So right now we are looking. So let's say that I am in the ground state, okay? Well, we know that actually any of the superpositions is possible. There is no reason, you know, this is linear algebra. And there is no reason, no mathematical reason to prefer, say, this state to this state, which is the symmetric superposition of the two. Okay? But you are right that if we make a measurement, we find this one and not this one. And the question is why? Because mathematically, there is no difference between these two things. And we will have a lot to say about this. So this is an incredibly important question. It has to do with the foundations of quantum statistical mechanics, the meaning of quantum theory. Because you see, this is also Schrödinger cat. Because this is the global 0-0. So you see, I'm encoding a lot of information here, and a lot of information here. And I'm saying, oh, this is the coherent superpositions of two macroscopic states. And we know that we don't measure these things. But now you see that your question is exactly the same question as why we don't measure these things. And there is nothing in quantum mechanics, in the way the theory is stated, that makes a difference. Because quantum mechanics is linear. But it's a great question. One of the goals of this course is to understand why these states, we don't see them. And to get there, we need a little bit more knowledge. Okay. So it is worthwhile to first try to compute the order parameter and the correlation functions in these states. Okay? Oh, first of all, what about symmetry here? If I take t on psi 0 up, what do I get? Psi 0 down. You see, I'm flipping all the spins. So I get psi 0 down. In other words, psi 0, both up and down, as a density matrix, will not commute with the symmetry. So symmetry is broken. And in fact, for almost every state in LGS, symmetry is broken. There are only two states that are actually commuting with T. And they are this one and this one. The symmetric and anti-symmetric state, they commute with the symmetry. These do not break the symmetry. Okay, so now let's fix something about our language, but in this case, it's also about our way of thinking. We discovered that the quantumizing model for G equals 0 breaks the symmetry. What it means is that the ground state manifold does not have the same symmetry of the Hamiltonian. However, mathematically, there is nothing that answers your colleague's question as to why the states that do not break the symmetry cannot be seen. So this phenomenon that needs to be explained at the physical level is what is called spontaneous symmetry breaking. And often this language is confused. people just call spontaneous symmetry breaking the fact that there is a symmetry breaking. But these are two different things. Symmetry breaking is a mathematical property of the ground state manifold. And spontaneous symmetry breaking is the fact that in this ground state manifold, only some states can be selected. In fact, those that maximally break the symmetry. This is the spontaneous symmetry breaking. What do I mean that I maximally break the symmetry? Let's say that I want to compute the commutator between psi 0 and t, and then I take the norm. So the commutator is an operator, and then the operator norm tells you how large is this operator. And then I want to maximize this anti-commutation over all the psi zeros in lambda GS. So if you find this maximum, you will see that you will find it for these two states, those that maximally break the symmetry. Okay. And you know, so if we actually do something different, imagine that we are at some finite temperature, and we are in the icing chain in 1D, and then we lower the temperature, so we go to the ground state. If we do it this way, we do find that the ground state that we'll find will be one half. Psi 0 will be 1 half of psi 0 up plus psi 0 down. So we will find the symmetric ground state. But look, this is not the symmetric ground state. This state is very different from this one. You see, this is a pure state. This is a mixed state. This is a coherent superposition. This is the classical mixture of the two pure states. So something fishy is happening in this broken symmetry, that not only we need to understand why it's spontaneous, but also it seems to make a difference between whether the state is symmetric as a pure state or a mixed state. So these are all things that we need to understand. Okay. So it's worthwhile to compute the magnetization and the correlation functions in the one that maximally breaks the symmetry. Because, as we know, though we don't understand why, those are the states that actually show up. Well, now you can see that M, so now we are in psi up, say. Now this is actually 1. Perturbation theory will show you, now you do perturbation theory in the other case, right? Now you switch on a small g. It will show you that here you have some function, let me call it n0 of g, which is 1 when g is equal to 0. So you see you have a non-vanishing order parameter for small g. Not only, you also have a degeneracy for all small g, just like you have it here for g equals 0. So you can understand that at some point this perturbation theory has to break down, because how can I change the degeneracy from being 2 to being 1 without closing a gap? And some gap has to close. And if the gap closes, perturbation theory will not be valid, because remember, it's what you have in the denominator. We're going to do it in the tutorial today. The correlation functions as you can see, they're also identically one. And in perturbation theory, they will be n squared g. This is called long range order. Okay. So now we discover something that is extremely important. That when we are in the non-symmetry broken phase, the order parameter is zero, and there is no long-range order. Correlations are vanishing. But when you are in the symmetry broken phase, and so you have two degenerate states, then the order parameter is non-vanishing, and you have a long-range order. No matter what is the distance between I and J, you have a non-vanishing value of these correlation functions. It's not decaying. So it seems that these properties, non-vanishing local order parameter and long-range order, are a property of the way you break a symmetry, or you don't break it. And for very, very long time, it was thought that, basically until the late 80s, and I should say even longer than that, that if you classify all the possible symmetries of a quantum Hamiltonian, you have classified all the possible states of the quantum many-body system. Remember our initial question is, what is possible in quantum mechanics? Until the early 90s, the answer was all that is classified by group theory. You take all the possible discrete groups, you look at all the possible patterns of symmetry breaking, and that's it. Okay. We'll see things are more complicated and more rich than that. So we will have order beyond symmetry breaking, which is one of the goals of this course. Let me, I cannot make it. So now today you will do the tutorial, you will do perturbation theory, and tomorrow I will actually prove you that without diagonalizing the model, that there is a point in which the gap closes. And it's a very simple, very beautiful proof because it relies, it's not brute force. You are not solving the model. It relies on duality. So this is the simplest example in which you can use duality to prove something about your model. And then we will start diagonalizing it, and that's quite a heavy thing to do, but it's important. Okay, see you tomorrow.